Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am kicking off the readings for the May 2023 edition of True West Magazine. Our first article, Pack Your Bags, Time to Get Western, by Melody Groves. Historic saloons, hotels, and ranches are ready to serve you up a slice of the Old West. If you're like me, tendrils of the Old West wrap around your heart and tug. Everywhere you look, remnants of times past are still evident. Go ahead, put your elbow on a saloon's bar where Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday did, or stay in a room where Clark Gable once slept. Seeking Old West venues, I've stayed at Durango's Strader Hotel, where I met astronaut Harrison Jack Schmidt. And I've sipped and dined at Tombstone's Big Nose Kate's. But nothing beats hearing saddle leather creak beneath me as my horse trots across pristine desert or mountain trails while nature smiles back. Whether you're looking for me time, family fun, or unique experiences of the Old West, look no further than this guide to hotels, saloons, and guest ranches. Many of the featured places have historic beginnings, but include modern accommodations. For over 100 years, visitors have been drawn to the area with its blue skies, unyielding views, and majestic soul. The West of yesterday is alive and well in many towns throughout the western states. If you're hankering to ride horses, lounge around a campfire, eat s'mores over mesquite flames, hoist a cold one over a beautiful Brunswick bar, breathe in insanely clean air, or simply stay still and listen to eagles soar through turquoise skies, these places are for you. A deep love of the Southwest grounds, Melody Groves. She has explored ghost towns, ridden horses, and traipsed through the desert. Melody recently won the coveted Spur Award for her book, Before Billy the Kid. She lives in Albuquerque. Arizona, Big Nose Kate's Saloon, 417 East Allen Street, Tombstone, Arizona. BigNoseKate'sTombstone.com. Kate Cummings, Doc Holliday's girlfriend, did not have a big nose. She got the moniker because she was nosy. Mystery solved. Stepping into the saloon restaurant is like reliving the 1800s. The authentic 1800s bar and wood floors harken back to days when miners, prospectors, cowboys, and drifters came through, each seeking food, alcohol, and a relaxing time. Today, this family-friendly saloon offers a variety of food and drinks and an intriguing underground shopping shaft. The saloon's long bar, one of two 1882 Great Fire survivors, served the Earps, Doc Holliday, the Clantons, possibly Kate herself, and continues to serve thirsty patrons today. Hacayampa Inn, 122 East Gurley Street, Prescott, Arizona, HacayPalmInn.com. Sleep where Will Rogers, Greta Garbo, Clark Gable, and Steve McQueen did. This beautifully restored 1927 boutique hotel sits in the heart of historic downtown Prescott, Arizona's territorial capital in 1864 to 67. The town's history of frontier gold and silver mining is evident throughout this hotel, with its Art Deco-inspired Peacock Room restaurant and the glass bar, providing live music nightly. Charming antique furniture, a quirky vintage elevator, and etched glass and embossed copper panels set off Spanish colonial revival architecture and Italianate features. Hacayampa Inn offers full-service banquet facilities and a variety of meeting spaces. Palace Restaurant and Saloon, 120 South Montezuma Street, Prescott, Arizona, WhiskeyRowPalace.com. With its origins stretching back to 1874, the Palace, originally known as Cabinet Saloon, has been the gathering place where locals could seek employment, hear news of the territory, or hoist a cold one with friends. Legend has it that patrons have included three of the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday, along with actors and movie crews filming Junior Bonner, Wishman, and Wanda Nevada. The exquisite back and front bars, 1890s Brunswick, survived two Whiskey Row fires by being hefted and carted across the street to the courthouse lawn. Story goes, the bar's protectors and movers then sat and toasted the flames with saved whiskey bottles. That spirit remains alive with a saloon that wouldn't die. Rancho de la Osa Guest Ranch, 1 La Osa Ranch Road, Sasabi, Arizona. RanchoDeLaOsa.com. Located adjacent to the 120,000 acres of Buenos Aires Wildlife Refuge, the historic Rancho de la Osa Guest Ranch offers horseback riding, swimming, biking, hiking, bird watching, sports shooting, wildlife photography, and more. Spend a relaxing evening enjoying Southwest-style cuisine with other guests or a cold one at the Cantina, the oldest continually occupied building in Arizona. An hour and a half drive south from Tucson, this 1924 ranch was founded in 1699 by Padre Kino, who brought cattle and sheep to surrounding villages. Today, it offers 19 luxurious adobe guest rooms with Mexican antiques, vintage furniture, and tons of history. Ranchos de la Caballeros, 1551 South Vulture Mine Road, Wickenburg, Arizona. RanchoDeLosCaballeros.com. 60 miles northwest of Phoenix, Rancho de los Caballeros, founded in 1948, is in Wickenburg, known for its clean air, wide open spaces, tourism, and outdoor adventure. Continuing a family tradition of generosity, the guest ranch offers southwestern hospitality and respect for the natural world. Furnished in the Santa Fe style, the ranch's 67 hotel rooms and 12 suites offer accommodations for everyone. With 13,300 sprawling acres, guests can enjoy horseback rides, golf, tennis, and pickleball, a heated pool, day spa, trap and skeet shooting, and archery. Meet other guests at the main dining hall with the all-inclusive dining plan, or on the Los Caballeros Club Grill's patio, which faces the Bradshaw Mountains. California, Rankin Ranch, P.O. Box 36, Caliente, California, RankinRanch.com. Ranch headquarters sit in the little valley of Walker's Basin, deep in the heart of the Tehachapi Mountains and southern end of the Sequoia National Forest. A working cattle ranch for 160 years, this six generations family-owned ranch covers 31,000 acres. Guest activities include horseback riding through meadow cattle country, swimming, hiking, trout fishing, and other outdoor games. Guests stay in duplex cabins and enjoy breakfast and a buffet-style dinner in the dining room. Each evening before dinner, adults gather for a patio party complete with appetizers. Children play in a recreation room or on the big lawn supervised by counselors. Weekly hay rides and barbecues in the meadow offer Sunday lunch and a horseshoes tournament. Colorado, See Lazy U Ranch. SeeLazyU.com, Granby, Colorado. Founded in 1919, this family-owned ranch provides a place where families can experience traditions of the American West. The heartbeat of the guest ranch is riding one of the 180 horses on the property. An indoor riding arena provides year-round equestrian enjoyment and clinical instruction from skilled riders. Mountainous trails traverse the 8,500-acre ranch. Fly fishing on Willow Creek, compete with paddle boats in a fishing pond. Enjoy the zip line, archery, a ropes course, outdoor pool, tennis, basketball, volleyball, and a children's playground. The 38 cabins are warm and spacious. Guests gather indoors or out for cocktails and appetizers while the chef prepares a healthy ranch dinner. Diamond Bell Saloon, 699 Main Street, Durango, Colorado. Strader.com. Located inside the Strader Hotel, the Diamond Bell Saloon is the real deal. Once home to the Strader Thorpe Drugstore, the Diamond Bell took form in 1957 and has grown into a world and locally famous watering hole. Locals and visitors gather once a week to swap stories, poems, and songs, and tap along with the talented ragtime pianist of the Bell. Cowboys no longer ride their horses into the saloon as they did not so long ago. A bullet hole in the back bar drawer speaks of more riotous times. Directly above the Bell is the room in which Western writer Louis L'Amour penned many of his novels. In addition to brews, the Bell serves creative appetizers, salads, burgers, and entrees. Hotel Colorado, Glenwood Springs, Colorado, hotelcolorado.com. Located in the heart of downtown, Hotel Colorado has been delighting guests since 1893. Steps from the Glenwood Hot Springs, guests appreciate the close proximity to the White River National Forest. After a full day of activities, enjoy family-friendly meals at the restaurant and bar or relax at the Coppertop Bar. Next day, fuel up with pancakes at the restaurant and bar, or later, enjoy an entree in the courtyard. Hotel Colorado has played host to Teddy Roosevelt, William Taft, and the unsinkable Molly Brown. Today, Hotel Colorado, a dog-friendly hotel, is an enchanting step back in time, inviting guests to take in the cool mountain air, healing hot springs, and exceptional service. Rainbow Trout Ranch, 1484 Forest Service Road, 250, Antonito, Colorado, rainbowtroutranch.com. Formerly a private fishing club, Rainbow Trout Ranch, snuggled in southern Colorado's San Juan Mountains, offers Old West history with 21st century comfort. The lodge, built in 1925, is filled with Old West pictures and memorabilia. Set at 9,000 feet, this ranch, spread over 160 acres, offers a full range of activities. Open-air cookouts and horseback riding with horses, perfect for each rider's abilities. Frisbee golf, invented in the early 1900s. Hiking, line and square dancing, special stories and sing-alongs for the children. And, of course, trout fishing on the Conejos River fill each day. Afterwards, enjoy the outdoor pool or hot tub. Rainbow Trout Ranch offers a memorable riding adventure of a lifetime. Strader Hotel, 699 Main Street, Durango, Colorado. Strader.com. Step into the Strader Hotel and history wraps its arms around you. Opened in 1887, today the hotel is a living museum and prominent landmark close to the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad. In the lobby, shadow boxes depict stories of the mining days. Well-crafted, handcrafted woodwork, period wallpaper, authentic and historic drapes, and a large collection of American Victorian walnut antiques decorate the hotel lobby and the 88 guest rooms. Each room has Wi-Fi, air conditioning, and private bathrooms. Complimentary coffee is in the lobby. Close to the Animas River and smaller silver mining boomtowns, the Strader offers a comfortable home base when exploring Durango or any of the nearby attractions. True Grit Cafe, 123 North Lena Street, Ridgeway, Colorado. TrueGritCafe.com. The True Grit Cafe, on the western slope of Colorado, offers a hand-cut, all-nature sirloins and ribeye steaks. True Grit Cafe also offers chicken-fried steaks. In fact, they've served over 5,300 annually. Built to honor the 1968 filming of John Wayne's True Grit movie, the cafe opened on New Year's Eve, 1985. Guests enjoyed learning about the history within the cafe, along with John Wayne memorabilia. Specializing in cowboy cuisine, they serve burgers, chicken fried steaks, and locally sourced pork. Their ranch to fork experience will surely fill empty stomachs. Sit on the deck and enjoy the mountainous background seen throughout the movie. Idaho, The Snake Pit. Inaville, Idaho. Snakepitidaho.com. A local landmark for over 140 years, the Snake Pit, located at the fork of the Coeur d'Alene River, has served as a boomtown bar, railroad layover, hotel, house of ill repute, and a starting point for loggers and miners. Today, this log cabin-style building is a wonderful combination of old and new. Stories about how the Snake Pit got its name are varied but colorful. Be sure to ask your server. The restaurant offers a full menu from Saturday prime rib specials to daily sirloin steak to barbecue to pancakes. A good selection of brews, ciders, and spirits round out the experience. Local acoustic musicians liven up the area with banjos and guitars on Friday nights. Montana, the Bay of Hay Saloon, 344 West Wallace Street, Virginia City, Montana. TheBaleOfHaySaloon.com. Hoist a cold one at the rustic Bale of Hay Saloon from mid-May to late September. Step into the character of the West in Montana's oldest established bar in Virginia City, a historic mining town. Known for its handmade hamburgers, brats, and a decent beer selection, many from local Montana breweries, the Bale offers free pool tables and shuffleboard. Inside is unique antique entertainment equipment, original cupboards behind the bar, old pictures and memorabilia on the walls, and a big potbelly stove. About 99% of the bar is original. An outside area is a pleasant place to sit and sip. The Grand Union Hotel, 1 Grand Union Square, Fort Benton, Montana. GrandUnionHotel.com. Over 100 years of history are displayed in the hotel and at historic Fort Benton. Built in 1882 during the steamboat era, the Grand Union Hotel on the Upper Missouri River was once proclaimed the finest hotel between St. Louis and Seattle. Listed on the National Register of Historic Places, the Grand Union is Montana's oldest operating hotel. Despite 140 years of ups and downs, today, the Grand Union shines with modernity. The hotel's 26 guest rooms are equipped with air conditioning and flat-screen televisions. Many offer a view of the Missouri River. The Grand Union and Union Grill are proud to continue the tradition of providing one of the state's grandest lodging and dining experiences. Nebraska, Rose's 1&1 Ranch, 833 Road, Burwell, Nebraska. 1+1ranch.com. This Nebraska Sandhills working cattle ranch, 90 miles from Kearney, gives guests the opportunity to truly be a cowboy. Run by the Rose family, the ranch offers guests a chance to learn to work cattle, ride, rope, brand, drive the herd, and sort cattle. Known for wide open spaces, genuine hospitality, phenomenal quarter horses, and unparalleled riding opportunities, the 1+1 Ranch provides lifelong memories. Accommodating a small number of guests in 6 updated Western log bunkhouses, the ranch guarantees personalized instruction. Meals are shared with family and friends at the main ranch lodge. Rose's 1+1 Ranch was recognized as a top cattle drive ranch by DudeRanch.com. New Mexico, Geronimo Trail Guest Ranch, 1 Wall Lake Road, Winston, New Mexico, GeronimoRanch.com. It's all about horses and relaxation at the Geronimo Trail Ranch. Horses are available for riding, grooming, feeding, or simply watching. Trails take riders through the canyons, atop mesas, and through the Gila National Forest, where Black Range views are breathtaking. At the only ranch of its kind in New Mexico, guests can ride as much or as little as they want. And with only 4 cabins accommodating up to 16 guests, the small numbers allow schedule flexibility. The only distractions are nature, herds of elk, deer, eagles, and 1,000-year-old cliff dwellings. After a relaxing day, savor ranch-style cooking in the dining hall or at outdoor barbecues. Open March through mid-November. Murray Hotel, 200 West Broadway Street, Silver City, New Mexico. Murray-hotel.com. Take a step back into 1938 when you sail through the doors of the Murray Hotel in downtown Silver City, New Mexico. Upon opening, the Murray soon became known for its Art Deco luxury and elegance. Today, restorations have returned the hotel to its original streamlined modern majesty and now include many green energy-efficient systems. Reopened in 2012, the 53 guest rooms and suites are spacious and comfortable, with complimentary breakfast included. Wall artwork tells the historic hotel's history. Locally produced artwork is on sale in the lobby. Many shops, restaurants, art galleries, and museums are within close walking proximity to the Murray. Plaza Hotel, 230 Plaza Street, Las Vegas, New Mexico. PlazaHotel-NM.com. Opening in 1882 as an upmarket hotel for the booming town of Las Vegas, New Mexico territory, the Palace Hotel, a three-story brick building with an Italianate facade, sits on the north side of the town plaza. Originally advertised as the Belle of the Southwest, the plaza lost favor when Fred Harvey opened the luxurious La Castaneda Inn as part of the Harvey House chain. Now remodeled, the Plaza Hotel is on the National Register of Historic Places. Tom Mix movies and television series have been shot there. The most recent was Longmire. A restaurant and bar are on the premises. St. James Hotel, 617 South Collision Avenue, Cimarron, New Mexico. EXSTJames.com. Built in 1872 on the historic Santa Fe Trail, the St. James Hotel has been a gathering place for over 140 years. Frenchman Henry Lambert built a saloon which became a hotel, frequented over the years by such characters as Buffalo Bill Cody, Annie Oakley, Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, Jesse James, Davy Crockett, and many others. 13 historic rooms have been updated, appointed with antique furnishings, and named for the famous people who have walked through the doors. A two-story annex with 10 extra rooms is adjacent. Hungry? Lambert's restaurant serves lunch and supper in a tin-stamped ceiling dining room. Or enjoy a cold one at the historic TJ's Bar. Oregon. Hamley Steakhouse and Saloon. 8 Southeast Court Avenue, Pendleton, Oregon. Hamley.com. Located in the heart of Pendleton, the Hamley Saloon and Steakhouse, open Tuesday to Saturday, has the region's most authentic Old West 100-year-old mahogany bar, which features oak woodwork and is watched over by Tex, a massive longhorn steer. Stained glass chandeliers complete the decor. Happy hour drinks and food set a tone for relaxation and conviviality. Looking for a bite? Hamley Cafe, open Monday to Saturday, offers a quiet, relaxing breakfast and lunch. Hamley Steakhouse offers takeout as well as dine-in. The restaurant specializes in prime rib and traditional ranch cooking. Stunning on the inside, Hamley Steakhouse and Saloon occupies a building dating from the Oregon Trail days and is filled with nostalgic Old West decor. South Dakota, Bullock Hotel, 633 Main Street, Deadwood, South Dakota. Historicbullock.com. Step back in time as you walk through the same rooms and hallways that Deadwood's first sheriff, Seth Bullock, still proudly haunts. Treat yourself to 19th century historical elegance combined with 21st century amenities. Within walking distance of downtown Deadwood, the hotel, built in 1895, offers 28 luxury rooms, a breakfast restaurant, Bully's, a full liquor bar, ghost tours, and a casino, open 24/7. The beautifully appointed rooms feature Wi-Fi and period furniture. Bully's, named after Teddy Roosevelt, is open for breakfast. The Bullock Hotel is definitely the jewel of downtown Deadwood and is the most photographed building in town. Texas. Rancho Cortez Dude Ranch. 872 Hay Holler Road, Bandera, Texas. RanchoCortez.com. This ranch, located in the Texas Hill Country and near San Antonio, offers cowboy experiences for everyone. Escape urban life for a half or full day or much longer. The ranch offers meals, horseback riding, swimming, hay rides, barrel racing, and fitness programs. Or stay overnight in the western-themed appointed lodging. Large porches, a refreshing outdoor pool, indoor pool, children's play area, and deck and hot tub complement a large dining and lodge room. A girls' horse summer camp for riders 8 to 16 teaches good horsemanship. A boys' cowboy camp for ages 8 to 18 teaches riding and roping skills, caring for livestock, and camping. Wyoming. Buffalo Bill's Irma Hotel. 1192 Sheridan Avenue, Cody, Wyoming. IrmaHotel.com. Built in 1902 by Buffalo Bill Cody, the Irma Hotel, which he called a gem, sits just outside the Yellowstone National Park. Named for Cody's youngest daughter, Irma, the hotel has seen its share of celebrity, princes, Indian chiefs, and movie stars. The rooms are named after influential Wyoming residents. Be sure to see the amazing Cherrywood Back Bar in the restaurant, a 1900 present from Queen Victoria of England to Cody for his performances in the Wild West shows. Enjoy a full menu at the restaurant, which serves steaks, seafood, and prime rib. Guests can sit on the porch and order a snack and drink while watching the gunfighters perform in the courtyard next door. Miners and Stockman's Steakhouse and Spirits, 608 Main Street, Hartville, Wyoming. Wyoming'sOldestBar.com. Wyoming's oldest bar at the Miners and Stockman's Steakhouse and Spirits offers steaks and an extensive wine list, plus 35 different types of whiskey. Housed in the last remaining remnants of the old Fort Laramie Trading Post, the steakhouse in Hartville, population 64, is adjacent to Guernsey State Park. Hartville, founded as a mining town, was rich in gold, silver, copper, and iron ore. The steakhouse has a reputation for serving mouth-watering beef. The bar guests see today was carved in 1862 in Germany, shipped to New York, trained to Cheyenne, and then to Fort Laramie to the Officers Club. In the 1880s, it was brought by wagon to Hartville. Open Thursday through Sunday. Occidental Hotel, 10 North Main Street, Buffalo, Wyoming. OccidentalWyoming.com. Since 1880, the Occidental Hotel has established a reputation for hospitality and fine food. Old West characters Buffalo Bill Cody, Teddy Roosevelt, Butch Cassidy, and Tom Horn spent time at the Occidental. Following a restoration in the early 2000s, this hotel is like truly stepping back in time. Embossed tin ceilings are original, as is the 25-foot back bar and wooden chairs. The saloon bullet holes are original, too. All rooms are furnished with different antiques and decor. Enjoy saloon beverages and a selection of dishes, or take your food out back to the beer garden, or dine in a nationally registered historic building at the Virginian restaurant in the hotel. Reservations recommended. We're going to go back now one edition to the April 2023 edition of True West Magazine to pick up two short stories that we haven't had time to read until now. The Lawful and the Lawless by Steve Friesen. Firearms at the Rock Island auction tell stories of violent days of frontier law and order. Rock Island Auctions presents firearms collectors with thousands of choices each year. Some of those firearms may not be inherently unique, but they received their value from the stories associated with their users. In December 2022, firearms linked to both the lawful and the lawless were among the standouts at the Rock Island Company's premier firearms auction. Theodore Roosevelt's Smith & Wesson New Model No. 3 was shipped to him on May 12, 1898, perhaps arriving in time for him to use it in the Spanish-American War. By that time, he had served as New York City Police Commissioner, and not too many years later, he would become Vice President and then President of the United States. The provenance of this revolver was enough to gather $910,625, the highest price at the auction. A Smith & Wesson revolver associated with the Sioux War also was sold at the auction. The story accompanying the firearm stated it was used to kill Sitting Bull when he resisted arrest by tribal police during the Ghost Dance. Most provenance was needed to definitely prove it, so it sold for just $26,438. On the losing side of an earlier conflict, the Civil War, Jesse James became one of America's most notorious outlaws. A Smith & Wesson first model Schofield revolver reported to have belonged to him, with holster, factory letter, and other documents, brought $152,750. The Civil War figured prominently in other offerings at the auction. A Burnside carbine presented by President Abraham Lincoln to Kentucky Congressman John J. Crittenden went for $105,750. The Crittenden story is just one of many poignant stories of families split by the conflict. Crittenden supported the Union while his eldest son fought for the Confederacy. Cowboy D.B. Gardner founded the Pitchfork Ranch in Texas. With an eye of enforcing the law, he also started the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association to fight cattle rustlers. His Colt Model 1862 Pocket Navy Conversion Revolver sold for $5,288. Cattlemen, lawmen, and outlaws alike used the Colt 45, nicknamed the Peacemaker. The Colt Single Action Army Sheriff's Model Revolver was a variation on it. An 1889 model sold for $64,625 at the auction. From Theodore Roosevelt to Jesse James, Rock Island's premier firearm auction offered plenty of tantalizing tales of the lawful and the lawless for collectors of the West. You Had to Look Hard, The Marquis de Morais Did, by Jana Bommersbach. His wife's beautiful name graces the charming town he left behind. Little Misery was about the only name you'd find in this part of the Dakota Badlands in the early 1880s. It sums up what life was like here for the few soldiers stationed to protect the railroad at the Little Missouri Cantonment Camp, nicknamed Little Misery. Yet this is where a Frenchman with an impressive title decided to stake his claim. The Marquis de Morais was an inventive, imaginative, ambitious man who once proclaimed, "I will be the richest financier in the world." He never made it, but he never had to worry about buying groceries either. His name was Antonin de Vallombrosa. He so adopted this spot in western North Dakota that he created a town, and in 1883 built his wife a 26-room, two-story hunting lodge for summer visits. He named the town after her. That's how we got Medora, one of the most charming Old West towns still in existence. These days, Medora is in a thriving mode as more and more visitors discover its treasures. The Chateau de Morais was the first and draws some 50,000 visitors a year. It's filled with thousands of personal items and furniture from the family that used it from 1883 to 86. The family maintained ownership until 1936 when the Marquis's oldest son, Louis, partnered with the State Historical Society to make the home a historic site, and a caretaker was hired to look after the property. Of course, restoration has always been a big priority here. In 2022, we were able to do significant repair and painting, notes Anne Killiam, the chateau's site supervisor. Almost every one of the 26 rooms got good care. They also completed a major restoration of the caretaker's cabin, built in 1939. In the chateau's rooms, one can get a glimpse at the life of a family and of a man who owned a beef packing plant, a stagecoach line, a freighting company, refrigerated rail cars, a cattle and sheep ranch, and dabbled in real estate. The town he created saw him as a wild Frenchman and didn't warm up to him. But Medora was beloved by the community. She was admired for her equestrian and shooting skills, and it didn't hurt that she came back to visit the chateau in 1903 and threw a ball for the local ranchers. These days, Medora has lots to offer, including a town built to serve visitors, a popular summer musical review, and the upcoming Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library that will open in a couple of years. But it all started because a Frenchman looked at this spot 140 years ago and didn't see misery. He saw magic. True West Magazine, May 2023 edition. The Tunnel Saloon Fight by Bob Bozbell. Pete Gabriel versus former deputy Joe Fye. A miraculous recovery. May 31st, 1888. Pete Gabriel, accompanied by his friend Mike Rice, leaves in a buggy from his Riverside gold mines, headed for Florence, Arizona Territory. As was usual with Gabriel on such trips, he had a quart of devil water along and imbibed freely of its contents. When we arrived in Florence, Gabriel was practically all in, Rice comments. After arriving in town, Pete was warned that Joe Fye, his former deputy, is looking to pick a fight. Pete pays no heed to the threat. The former Pinal County Sheriff retires to the Tunnel Saloon for drinks with owner John Keating. When Sidney Bartleson sees Pete enter the saloon, he rushes to tell his friend Fye that the ex-sheriff is in town. Fye buckles on his gun rig, grabs a bowie knife, and heads for the Tunnel Saloon. Pete spots Fye peering in a window. He reaches for his gun, but Fye disappears. As patrons enter the saloon, Pete drops his hand to his six-shooter, which is tucked into his waistband. At 8 p.m., Fye returns, coming through doors with his pistol drawn. One witness claims Fye didn't have his gun out. Pete yells out, "Joe!" perhaps both as a taunt and a greeting, and both men open fire. One shot snuffs a lamp. The former lawman partners exchange 11 shots as Pete works his way down the bar to the floor. Fye lunges forward, a six-shooter in his right hand and a bowie knife in his left, and fires point-blank into Pete's chest. The bullet tears into Pete's right lung. Another slug from Fye's gun pierces Pete's intestines. Incredibly, Pete stays on his feet as he backs out of the door, returning fire. One of Pete's bullets hits Fye in the left thigh, shattering the bone. Another slams into his belly. As Fye buckles over in pain on the sidewalk, Pete fires point blank, hitting Fye in the right shoulder and piercing through both lungs. "Oh my God, I'm down," comes Fye's gasping response. When a local gambler named Gibson tries to help Fye, who is now lying in his death throes in a ditch north of the saloon, the dying man swings his bowie knife, slashing at the gambler's leg and gasping out, "You murdering son of a bitch." Prelude to the Tunnel Fight. John Peter Gabriel is born on November 17, 1838 in Kreft, Germany, the fourth of six children. When Pete is nine, his parents immigrate to the United States. After Pete's 62-year-old father dies, Anna cannot support her family, so the 12-year-old boy is taken in by a prominent lawyer who soon joins the California Gold Rush. There, 16 miles north of Marysville in the Yuba River region, Pete grows up among the rough gold miners and gamblers. In his early 20s, he becomes, by turns, a gold miner, a mule skinner, and a guide. The only knock against Pete is that he suffers from severe mood swings, which are exacerbated by his drinking, which he tends to do a lot, his two ex-wives confirm. Pete soon gravitates to being a lawman in Arizona Territory. Several times he will be elected sheriff. During one election, the vote ties, and the two candidates roll dice to determine who will serve. Pete loses, taking it all with grace and humor. In November 1884, Pete is elected by a 130-vote majority to his third and last two-year term as Pinal County Sheriff. He appoints 39-year-old Josephus Fye as his deputy. A miner and freighter, Fye is born in Platte County, Missouri on May 22, 1844. At age 15, he runs away from home, eventually landing in Arizona Territory, where he is taken in by attorney Granville Ory and his wife. Fye unsuccessfully runs for Phoenix Sheriff in 1872. He later serves as Maricopa County Deputy Sheriff. In 1878, he is appointed a Deputy U.S. Marshal. Fye neither drinks or smokes, but he has one trait he shares with Pete. He, too, has a bad temper. In 1886, Pete plans to retire from lawing, so he throws his support behind his deputy. But then, in Casa Grande, Fye pistol whips a teamster who claimed Pete had disparaged his opponent in the sheriff race. Fye also swings at a woman who tries to intercede. Pete is forced to arrest his deputy and then fire him. That starts the bad blood between the two former friends. By the spring of 1888, Pete is working his Monitor mine at the head of Mineral Creek in the Dripping Springs Mountains, northeast of Florence. When Pete arrives in Florence on May 31st, he hears that Fye is gunning for him. Against all odds, Pete survives his serious wounds from the gunfight against Fye. Within a month, he's up and running. But the fight still haunts him. The killing of Fye preyed on Pete as long as he lived, Mike Rice recalls. He expressed his regrets to me on many occasions. It worried him in his waking and sleeping hours to the extent that he was often irrational on the subject. Once, on the desert, while we were occupying the same blankets, he dreamt of his encounter with Fye and, in a somnambulistic condition, fired off every shot in his gun, at the same time exclaiming, "Joe, Joe, Joe." Pete is still shooting at ghosts in the tunnel saloon. Aftermath odds and ends. After the shootout, bystanders carried Joe Fye to the stage company corral. A doctor removed one of the bullets, but couldn't do much more. Fye died from internal bleeding at 12:30 a.m. Friends carried Pete Gabriel to an adobe house next to the Pinal County Sheriff's Office. Hearing the news that the doctor would first treat Fye, Pete allegedly screamed, "What? My family physician treating my enemy before coming here? Tell him I won't have his services. I don't want him here." Another doctor, Thomas Sabin, was summoned from his residence 18 miles away. After traveling 4.5 hours, the doctor reached Pete's bedside and told the ex-sheriff the bad news. "You are shot through the intestines and right lung, and your condition is hopeless." Pete supposedly replied, "Well, I had one lung shot anyway in Los Angeles years ago. But by God, I will beat you to it and be without lungs and still be a better man than any of my enemies." A tough old bird, and true to his word, Pete was back on his feet within a month. 6 months later, he was in the saddle as a deputy sheriff, hunting southwestern stage robber Ham White. A year later, Pete took part in the manhunt for the Apache Kid, who, with three companions, had killed a sheriff and a guard on the way to being locked up at the prison in Yuma. Pete retired from the law once again to pursue mining. On June 30th, 1898, the former lawman died after drinking poisonous water, probably cyanide, at his mine in the Dripping Springs Mountains. Recommended, Pete Gabriel, Gunfighting Lawman of the Southwestern Frontier, by John Bossenecker. The Journal of Arizona History, Spring 2012. Look for his book, Shotguns and Stagecoaches, The Brave Men Who Rode for Wells Fargo in the Wild West. True West Magazine, May 2023 edition. Vera's Life in the Circus Was a Zoo, by Jana Bommersbach. Her $10 greenhorn mistake didn't help. The first time Vera McGinnis entered the Big Top at Madison Square Garden in New York City, she looked like a giant Dresden doll. She was atop a black horse, wearing a gigantic hoop skirt that hung from her waist. It flounces, reaching the ground. Her head held a giant picture hat with ostrich plumes. The huge backstage seemed like a fairyland to me, she had later write. The costumes were all crisp, new, and beautiful. Everyone went in, the spectacular parade that opened the show, dressed in fancy costumes. The six of us from the Wild West division had the most beautiful costumes a designer ever dreamed up, also the most uncomfortable. This was the greatest show on earth, and the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus paid a lot of attention to the flash and dash of showmanship. The 1923 run at the Garden was easy and fun. There was enough space for everyone to be camped right by the big tent, and it was a cinch to do several costume changes in one day, either to show off or to perform. So Vera wasn't prepared for how different things would be on the road. She soon found that her Wild West dressing room, known as the Hooligan, was at the bottom of the pecking order. The big dressing rooms of the circus stars were naturally adjacent to the back door of the Big Top. Then came the band top for musicians and their instruments, the circus doctor's office, the wardrobe tents, and the pad room for the performing horses. After all that came space for the Hooligan, and finally, the cages for the performing animals. Vera found all this worked fine, as long as we were pitched on a lot big enough to carry out the pattern. But when there wasn't room for all the tents, the first to be ousted was the Hooligan. Sometimes it was blocks away. So Vera did a lot of walking. We walked back and forth for horses, for wardrobe, for food, for everything. No matter how hot or miserable the weather, she wrote in her autobiography, Rodeo Road, My Life as a Pioneer Cowgirl. Had I not been a First of May, as the old circus hands would call the brand new ones, I'd never have let myself in for a lot of the work I had to do that summer, she wrote. My official job was to trick ride in the concert. That meant that first I'd have to ride spec, as everyone did, then go back into the Big Top for the Wild West lineup about halfway through the regular show. Then I'd be through until concert time. That is, I would have been, had I not of my own free will made different arrangements. I signed up to work with the background group for Mrs. Branda's Act Beautiful. She did a bareback routine, and we stood on the ring curb with baskets of pigeons we released at the end, which settled on Mrs. Branda and her pure white horse. Though it added $10 per week to my check, I realized it was just another greenhorn mistake. After displaying her Dresden doll costume, Vera had to run back and change into her Western duds, then run back again to change into the Act Beautiful costume, then dash one more time to get back into her Western outfit to perform. I really earned that extra $10, especially through the Midwest in hot weather, she wrote. Vera settled into a hectic routine, but saw it as just that, a routine without the challenge and hazards of rodeo life. That is, until Friday the 13th of June in South Bend, Indiana, when her friend Gordon Jones teased her into agreeing to do his Pony Express act. I vaulted to Gordon's saddle and left in high, made a flying charge onto the second horse and raced down to the back side of the track, she wrote. As she tried to dismount for yet a third horse, her mount shied, his head hitting her in the mouth. I literally saw stars and hung on to the saddle horn to keep from falling, one hand cupped over my mouth. Another rider took over the scene while Vera went looking for the circus doctor. He was startled as she took her hand away from her mouth. Blood, a couple of teeth, and a little horsehair were mixed up inside. He cleansed the wound and gave me a hasty examination. Her upper jawbone was crushed, and the doctor was relieved that the next stop was Chicago, where specialists Vera needed would help put her back together. After months in remote parts of the country, living in a tent and bathing in a bucket, Vera had been looking forward to the excitement of Chicago, with a clean hotel room and the promise of a real hot bath. The fun I had in Chicago was in a dentist chair, getting bone splinters removed and submitting to all sorts of treatment. She got a temporary plate with three teeth and kept performing, keeping her mouth shut unless one of the girls prodded her into a toothless grin. She later got a permanent bridge. I simply pushed the episode behind me to drag along with the inevitable physical burdens all rodeo performers have, she wrote nonchalantly. When the circus closed, Vera went straight back to Madison Square Garden for the rodeo. It seemed nothing could cure me. Jana Bomersback has earned recognition as Arizona's Journalist of the Year and won an Emmy and two Lifetime Achievement Awards. She co-wrote the Emmy-winning Outrageous Arizona and has written three true crime books, a children's book, and the historical novel Cattle Kate. True West Magazine, May 2023 edition. Alchemist of the Vine by Sherry Monahan. California's grape growers discovered a gold mine in distilling aged brandy. Until the mid-1800s, Mission grapes were the primary winemaking grape in California. As time progressed, Mission grapes were used for brandy, table wine, and Angelica, which was a fortified wine. A few 19th century winemakers experimented with brandy. Jacob Beringer left his home in Mainz, Germany in 1868 to start a new life in the U.S. He was enticed by his brother Frederick, who had sailed to New York 5 years earlier and constantly wrote home about the grand opportunities in the vast new world. Jacob had enjoyed working in wine cellars in Germany when he was younger and heard the warm, sunny climate of California was ideal for growing grapevines. So in 1870, he traveled west by train, first to San Francisco and then on to Napa Valley. Upon his arrival, he discovered rocky, well-drained soils similar to those in his native Rhine Valley. In 1875, the brothers bought 215 acres that had a 28-acre vineyard already planted with white Riesling, Chapelet, and grapes to blend Cabernet Sauvignon. In 1876, they founded the Beringer Brothers Winery and crushed 40,000 gallons of wine. In 1883, Frederick permanently moved to the Napa Valley and began construction of a 17-room mansion that was to be his home, which was a recreation of the Beringer family home on the Rhine River in Germany. The Rhine House is the center of Beringer's reserve and library tastings. An 1888 Napa Journal article stated, "Beringer brothers have withdrawn 250 barrels of grape brandy from the bonded warehouse for export to Bremen, to be shipped from San Francisco by the clipper ship Deutschland. They have also withdrawn from the Santa Rosa warehouse the same amount for the same place." In 1854, General William Tecumseh Sherman and General Fightin' Joe Hooker ventured into the winemaking business and planted grapes on their land. They only kept the Madrone Ranch for a few years. In 1863, Virginia-born George Washington Whitman purchased it. By 1876, Whitman's vineyard was producing 50,000 gallons of brandy. In 1883, Eli T. Shepherd bought the winery and named it Madrone. Because of poor health, Shepherd sold Madrone to U.S. Senator George Hearst and father of publisher William Randolph Hearst in 1888. The sale included 400 acres, including a winery, distillery, wine cellar, and 80,000 gallons of wine and brandy. Christian Brothers Brandy was started by the Christian Brothers, the largest religious community of men devoted entirely to education worldwide. The brothers were priests and laymen who were dedicated to living and working in a teaching congregation. They began in 1882 in San Joaquin Valley when the order purchased vineyards to make sacramental wine for their community. Their reputation for creating excellent wine grew, and they began producing it and selling it to benefit their schools. Francis and Joseph Korbel were natives of Bohemia, now part of Czechoslovakia, and landed in New York. They arrived in San Francisco in the early 1860s, and by the late 1860s, they opened Korbel Cigar Box Factory. During the 1870s, the Korbels grew prunes, beets, wheat, and corn, and ran a commercial dairy in the Russian River Valley. They entered the wine business in the early 1880s and experimented with several grape varieties, including Pinot Noir. Despite Pinot Noir being unusual for California's vineyards, the Korbels chose to work with them. As their wine business grew throughout the 1880s, they sent for Prague winemaker Frank Hasek. After the debut of his champagne-like sparkling wine, Francis Korbel began producing his premium Korbel California Brandy in 1889. On February 25, 1900, Joseph Korbel died after a brief illness. Francis Korbel ran the business in 1901 and saw an opportunity to utilize the many prunes growing on his land. He experimented for more than a year, trying to turn them into brandy. The San Jose Evening News concluded, "He made a brandy which was fairly good, but which had neither the cheapness of production nor any special quality. Thanks to a long legacy, you can still enjoy their brandy, not just the prune kind."
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.